After sitting at the feet of Martin Luther King at the University of Michigan in 1963, Larry Brilliant was swept up into the civil rights movement, marching and protesting across America and Europe. As a radical young doctor, he followed the hippie trail, from London over the Khyber Pass with his wife, also with Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farm Commune, to India. There, he found himself in a Himalayan ashram, wondering whether he had stumbled into a cult. Instead, one of India's greatest spiritual teachers opened Larry's heart and told him his destiny was to work for the World Health Organization to help eradicate killer smallpox. Dr. Larry Brilliant would become a key player in eliminating a 10,000-year-old disease that killed more than a half a billion people in the 20th century alone. He would become a full-fledged medical officer in the UN's World Health Organization and a member of their Southeast Asia program's central team. Brilliant's incredible trajectory is chronicled in his memoir, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventures of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. The book is published by Harper One, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Larry Brilliant to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great honor.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you. What brought you to want to write the book and to write the book at this point?
I think I've been writing this book for, almost 40 years. When I came back after living in India for 10 years, after we had eradicated smallpox, I wrote an article called Death for a Killer Disease, and I wrote a textbook or a scientific book on smallpox. And a friend of mine, Dan Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence, began then to kind of, I would say, nudge me, but it was stronger than that, to write a memoir. And so I started taking all my diaries from that time and organizing it and writing little stories here and there. But it really, life intervened, and I just never wrote it until I got started in earnest about a year and a half ago. But so 40 years of wanting to tell this story. I think over those years, so many people told me, please stop telling me the same story over and over again. And Sheryl Sandberg, who I'd worked with at Google, and a very dear friend of mine, she said, Larry, you'll never be a good public speaker until you can deliver at least a half-hour talk without mentioning smallpox once. And to get it out of your system, why don't you write a book? Then you could just hand me the book, and I won't have to hear the stories again.
One of the points that you make in the book, and one of the things that becomes clear, is that you somehow are always in the right place at the right time. Did you feel that way at the time?
I didn't feel that way until I saw Forrest Gump, and people began telling me that I was a Forrest Gumpian creature, you know. No, I don't think so. I think that you cannot see the trajectory of time prospectively. I joke that in medical school, we're given all sorts of scopes to study, gastroscopes and proctoscopes and sigmoidoscopes. But the only scope that really is of any value is the retrospectoscope, because it's only looking backwards that we can really see the flow of history. And certainly if you're in it yourself, I couldn't tell at that time that meeting Martin Luther King or being part of the movement or you couldn't see those trends going forward. At least I couldn't. Some people can.
Talk a little bit about that, the hippie life that you led that brought you to India, to that would then allow you and to understand that where you belonged and where you needed to be for that moment was with the World Health Organization.
Well, when I was in medical school in Detroit, and I had been an activist. I'm happy to say I was arrested with Martin Luther King once. I marched with him several times. But I was an activist, and I was a medical student. And we got an opportunity during the LBJ years. A lot of medical students were invited to come and become federal employees for the summer. It was a summer job. to try to enforce the 1965 Civil Rights Act, Title VI, which said it was now illegal to discriminate against African Americans or anyone else in hospital settings and still receive federal money. So an organization was created, it was part of the Great Society, and it was called the Office of Equal Health Opportunity. We don't have too many of those acronyms floating around as much as we did in those days.
Right.
And as a summer job, I was sent to either desegregate hospitals in Mississippi or nursing homes in Ohio, or inspect them for abuse of the Civil Rights Act. And in the middle of 1967, in the middle of the summer of love, I was shipped off in a federal plane to go to San Francisco. And sending a young boy from Detroit, Michigan, into San Francisco in the middle of the summer of love is just not fair. I had no defenses. I was not prepared. I didn't know how to say no. So I followed Oscar Wilde's advice. He said the only way to deal with temptation is to yield to it.
And you did what was being done at the time.
Amen.
So how did that bring you to India?
So after I came back to medical school, my wife and I decided that I would do my internship in San Francisco, and she would become a parole officer. And so we went back to San Francisco. I did my internship for 1 year. And then a group of Native Americans took over Alcatraz Island because Alcatraz Island, which of course had been a famous prison, was declared surplus federal property. And there was a treaty, the Treaty of Laramie, which said that when land having been taken from Native Americans becomes surplus property, it reverts back to the ownership of the Native American tribe from which it came. And so a group of Native Americans appealed to the federal government to give them back Alcatraz, and the federal government, not for the first time, declined to honor a treaty obligation. And so Native American kids took over the island. One of the older women on the island, Lou Trudell, was 8.5 months pregnant, and she wanted to give birth to her baby on the island, on Indian reclaimed land. And there was no water, there was no electricity, no medical care on the island. And a San Francisco columnist, Herb Kane, every week would write, is there no doctor willing to go out and break the Coast Guard blockade and go live on the island and take water and medicine and help this woman deliver a baby? Is there no doctor? And he just kept on saying this over and over again. And I thought that was like an advertisement that said, Larry, come to Alcatraz. So I lived on Alcatraz and helped in her delivery. And when I came off the island, it was a news event on the front page of the local newspapers, but it seemed like every TV camera nationally was pointed in my face asking me, what do the Indians want? Which was preposterous. I was from Detroit, Michigan. I had never met an Indian until I got on an Alcatraz. But somebody from Warner Brothers saw my interview and offered me a job in a movie, a terrible movie as it turned out, about hippies and about big bands, Jethro Tull, Pink Floyd, all the great bands of the time, living in teepees, going kind of, I think the idea was reverse the pilgrims, travel from England, but this time start in San Francisco and wind up in Canterbury. And so I lived on a bus caravan with a bunch of hippies, Wavy Gravy and the Grateful Dead and the psychedelic buses of Ken Kesey's followers. And my wife and I just loved it. And I was a rock doc, but we joined the caravan. We ran away with the circus. And when we got to England, we decided as a group to get a couple more buses and drive from Canterbury, from England, to Kathmandu, which took us a couple of years. And we drove through. Of course, we lived in Turkey and Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal. And that trip can't be made anymore today, which I really lament, that the people who I met on that trip I know we're at war with some of them now, or their descendants. But when I met those people, they were as kind and loving and hospitable as you could imagine. We must have looked like Martians as we drove up to a little Kurdistani village that was near Mount Ararat. But they treated us like visitors and fed us and sang for us and, you know, helped us wash our clothes. I mean, and I'll just say one more thing, because this is the middle of a very contentious election. Whether we go to these little villages and I had my medical kit and I would do surgery or, you know, treat minor wounds or give antibiotics or whatever it was called for. And we'd go into these little villages in Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq. I mean, these names sound really frightening right now to many people. But if it was a little Muslim village, in the middle of that village on a shrine would be a picture of Mecca. And if it was a Buddhist village, there'd usually be an image of Buddha. Hindu village, there'd be a picture of Ram or Sita or Vishnu or Shiva. And not all the time, I want to be clear, not all the time, but 2 out of 10 times maybe, 1 out of 10, 3 out of 10 times on that shrine, in the most sacred part of the center of that little village in the most faraway place, in addition to that picture of Mecca or that image of Ram or that statue of Buddha, in addition to, there'd be a picture of John F. Kennedy, a picture of our president. Because America meant that to those people in that day. And, you know, it probably sends a little chills up your spine. It certainly does for me. Because aspirationally, America was something that represented to people in an impoverished world a country that is great because it was good, a country that was something akin to your, you know, your old crazy uncle who, if you called him in an emergency, would bail you out or give you a ticket. That's, in a way, what we represented. And then over time, the kids, the children of those people would come to America and go to school here. And that's what America, after the Second World War, represented. In the middle of the Cold War, most countries of the world wanted there to be a single sole superpower, us, because we represented, aspirationally at least, and we had our problems, we made our mistakes, but we represented something to aspire to, and it'll be a long time before there's a picture of another American president in those villages. And you asked me why I wrote the book. The first reason I wrote the book was to tell the story of how people from all over the world, every race, every color, every religion, every language, worked together to eradicate smallpox. But as I began to do that and people read my stories, I realized it's not, I don't want to say it's an antidote for the vitriol and the hatred and the, you know, racism that we've seen in the political world today. It's not an antidote. It's just another way of looking at the world. I saw a world where people of every race, every religion, every language could come together and fight for a common good, the elimination of a horrible disease.
Larry Brilliant is our guest. The name of the book, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. We will continue our conversation after this short break. The new book, Sometimes Brilliant, tells the true life adventures of a pioneering physician, hippie, tech innovator, philanthropist, and key player in the eradication of one of the worst pandemics in human history. Dr. Larry Brilliant has written the book, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventures of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. When did smallpox come onto your radar as something that you could get involved in trying to conquer?
Well, I was living in a monastery in an ashram in India, at the corner of India, Nepal, and China, Tibet. If you think about that map, in that little corner, there's a little dot, and that's where I was, in a place called Kenchi in the Kamoan Hills. And my guru, this fat old man in a blanket, living in a Hindu monastery, but teaching us to read the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran and Lao Tse and the Dhammapada, and all, really to try to understand as many religions as we could. And what he one day called me aside and said that he was going to send me out of that sheltered place, and that he was going to send me down to New Delhi, which was about a 15 or 16 or 17 hour trip away on train, a bus, a rickshaw, a taxi, a combination of vehicles. He was going to send me out of the ashram to go down to the United Nations World Health Organization, and that there I would find a job working to eradicate smallpox, this terrible disease, because it was God's gift to humanity that this one form of suffering, this one burden, would be lifted from the shoulders of people. Now, there were a number of things that I thought absolutely ridiculous about that. First, I had indeed got my medical degree and done an internship, and that was it. I had never seen a case of smallpox. I was barely a doctor. I could barely remember practicing medicine, which was not very much time.
Right.
And the United Nations World Health Organization only hired people who were recruited from NIH or CDC or the equivalent in Russia or in England. I would have been younger than anybody else by almost two decades, 15 years, and I had no experience. And, of course, when I walked into the WHO building, I was wearing an ashram gown and hair down to the middle of my back and a beard to my knees. And they kicked me out, of course, immediately. And I went back to the ashram, another 15, 16, 17-hour trip. And he sent me back again a dozen times. And each time I would become more frustrated and pessimistic and skeptical that maybe my guru was in his right senses. And the idea that the other thing wrong with that was there was no smallpox eradication program at WHO in India at that time, because the Prime Minister, Mrs. Indira Gandhi, was properly using resources for things that were more important to India. Mm. More children were dying of diarrhea and pneumonia than they were of smallpox. And so I kept being sent down to WHO and being kicked out. I kept going back because of the optimism that my guru had for this. And in a way, it was like an impossible dream that I could go work for WHO. I mean, and in the end, they set up a smallpox program somewhere between my 10th and 15th visit to WHO, and they created a position. They had to create a position low enough that they could hire me. And I can tell you that I'm the only person in the history of the United Nations to be recruited from the monkey temple in the Himalayas. Everybody else has been recruited from a government or a university, but on my papers it says place of recruitment, and literally it's written monkey temple Himalayas.
Got to be a little proud about that, sure.
I'm very proud of that.
You have a graph in the book of the incidence of smallpox in central India. And if you look at around 1970, it's infinitesimal. It's maybe a few cases. And just skyrockets to nearly 50,000 in 1974. What was happening to allow that surge?
Well, it wasn't a surge in cases. It was a surge in reported cases. And therein lies the great accomplishment of the smallpox program. Nobody was reporting smallpox in India, and nobody means not very many people. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. First, smallpox wasn't really considered by everybody a disease. It came every year. It seemed ubiquitous. It seemed eternal. It clearly had been around for thousands and thousands of years. Now, that may sound like, oh, those stupid Indians. I don't mean it that way. I mean, we have every year an influenza outbreak in the United States. Right. 30,000 people die. But we don't talk of it as if it were an epidemic or a pandemic. We are, too, accustomed to influenza. 350,000 people died last year worldwide from influenza. If it were any other disease, you'd be reading about it on the front page of the newspaper. But we are inured to it. And I think Indians were inured to smallpox. So they didn't bother to report it because there was no treatment for it. There was no way to alleviate the symptoms of it. There still isn't. If anybody got smallpox today, we could not cure it. The only thing we could do was prevent it. And we had had a great vaccine for 200 years, but we hadn't been able to eradicate smallpox until a fellow named Bill Fagy noticed when he was a missionary physician in Africa that if he allocated his scarce vaccine just to the people who were close to another case or in a circle around them or in their family, smallpox disappeared. Whereas the old way of trying to vaccinate everybody, blanket, did not stop smallpox. It just kind of dampened it down, and it would arise again later. And we had a great guy, D.A. Henderson, whose funeral will be next week. I don't know when you're playing this, but D.A. was the dean of Johns Hopkins University and the head of the smallpox eradication program globally. Mm-hmm. And we had some wonderful people, M.I.D. Sharma in India, Nicole Grasse from France. Literally, there were doctors from 175 nations who came together, and particularly Russians and Americans in the middle of the Cold War, when we had 40,000 nuclear weapons aimed at each other. That's quite a hatchet to bury, 40,000 nuclear weapons. But still we did it, and we came together and we worked together along with people from India and 175 other nations to eradicate smallpox. And that, to me, is the great lesson. So we found every case of smallpox. We put a circle of immunity around it. Now, finding every small case of smallpox at the same time required going to every single house in India and searching every house in India. And at that time, India had about 600 million population. There were about 100, 120 million households. We visited every single house in India once a month for 20 months. That's more than 2 billion house calls. We had 150,000 people working to eradicate smallpox. So the scale of it was very large, but the actual practical application of it was pretty simple. Find every case of smallpox. Vaccinate everybody who is susceptible, who is likely to catch the disease. Repeat.
There are so many facets of your career that there are, too many to get into in the time we have left. But let me just go through a couple here that I am interested in. And because not only do you have this medical work and the spiritual work that you're doing, but you're also a techie. So what got you into that field, and how you could use your experience and make a difference in what was emerging as a technological age?
So after smallpox was eradicated, we all went back to our universities. Everybody except me had been recruited from NIH or Michigan or Harvard or Moscow. I was recruited from the Monkey Temple, of course, in the Himalayas, and I went back there for a little while, but ultimately came back home to Ann Arbor, Michigan, my home, and I became a professor. My wife worked on her PhD, and while we were there, we kind of got a little bored, if truth is to be told, and the excitement of helping to eradicate smallpox was like a mountain climber climbing Everest for the first time. It was the only disease in history ever eradicated. I hope that soon, very, very soon, polio will join that as the second disease, human disease, eradicated. Anyway, we wanted to do it again. And my boss from WHO, Nicole Grasse, and Bill Fagy, and my friends from the smallpox program, and my hippie friends, Wavy Gravy, and my friends from the spiritual world who had been with Neem Karoli Baba, my guru, we all got together, and we started an organization called SEVA. And we decided that we would work on something different. We'd work on blindness. There were 42 million people in the world who were blind from something that was preventable or curable. So we decided that we'd go to Nepal, which was the hardest place we could think of to work, and we would do a survey and try to find out epidemiologically, scientifically, what's the major cause of blindness and how do you build a program? And to do that, we had to have a helicopter. The Grateful Dead did a benefit. The helicopter was donated. It shipped to Kathmandu. I had a helicopter for 6 months. Mm. We went to 108 villages to try to figure out, you know, what were the major causes. We gave medical care to 40,000 people. And on the last day of the survey, the helicopter crashed. It crashed in a way that didn't endanger the helicopter. Nobody was hurt, but the engine had auto-digested itself. And there I was in Kathmandu, the helicopter was far off in the boonies in Nepal, and I had to figure out how to get a replacement engine flown in, put it onto the helicopter, and get them both out of the country on the way home. And Steve Jobs, which famously started Apple, and had become a close friend of mine because he came to that same ashram in the Himalayas, and when I started Seva, he gave me the first money and gave me an Apple II and a Corvus hard drive and a Hayes modem. And I was sitting there in Kathmandu with Steve's computer, and I don't know if you remember the Hayes modems and the acoustic modems, you know, the kind
yeah.
of cats. So I had that, and I had somebody from the UN who was a satellite guy, and we managed to hook up the computer and call up to a passing satellite, sounds romantic, over the Himalayas, and bounce the signal back to the University of Michigan, get on the University of Michigan computing system, and connect to Senator Hatfield's office in Oregon and the helicopter company, we're both from Oregon, and the SEVA office in Ann Arbor and the UN office in New York and the WHO office in Geneva and all these different people to organize the repair and removal of the helicopter. And 72 hours later, the helicopter was repaired and removed and flew out under its own power with the old engine under its belly. And all of that was organized using something which is now known as computer conferencing. We didn't really have a name for it then. That's how I first got excited by what technology could do to systems. And when I came back to Ann Arbor and Steve Jobs was visiting me and staying at my house in Ann Arbor, and I made the mistake of asking him for more money for SEVA, he said, what you just showed me, this thing that you just did with that helicopter in Nepal, that's new. You should start your own company, make your own money, fund your own charity, and I'll help you. Except he said a little more colorfully than that. And he did. And so did his old roommate from Reed College. And we wound up starting a company which became The Well. One of the products of that company became The Well, which is still alive today, 40 years later. You can still use The Well. It was the first, some people say, it was the first online network. Wired magazine said it was the most social, it was the most influential social network of all times. I don't know about that, but it's kind of them to say that. And that's what got me into technology, because a lot of the companies that were getting started at that time in Silicon Valley, you know, whether it was eBay or whatever it was, they would use The Well as their kind of bulletin board or gathering place. The Well stood for Whole Earth Electronic Link, and its success was directly linked to Stuart Brand, who was the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, and he was my partner. He had half of The Well, and I and my company had half of it.
Larry Brilliant is our guest. The name of the new book is Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. The other part that I want to focus in is the work that you're doing now, because it's fascinating, because you are looking still very much at the medical side of pandemics, but also specifically the threats posed by climate change. And I'm hoping we can close with you talking a little bit about that work and why it's so important, and if possible, to give us hope in that sense of what you're seeing and what the possibilities are.
Well, I'm very optimistic about being able to build a robust system that can protect us from pandemics. Whether it's Ebola or Zika or swine flu or bird flu or SARS or MERS or any of these other tragic diseases that emerge from animals jumping to humans, these outbreaks are inevitable. But it is not at all inevitable they will progress to be pandemics. Just as in smallpox, the trick is to detect them early and to put a ring of protection around them. In this case, that ring of protection might be simple quarantine or social distancing. It might be a vaccine or an antiviral the sophistication of our ability to find these new outbreaks is increasing so much, and I'm just so pleased with that, how that is going directionally. The group that I'm the chairman of, the Skoll Global Threats Fund, that was started by my friend Jeff Skoll, who was the president of eBay, and who has Participant Media, which has done some wonderful movies. What we look at pandemics and climate change and water and nuclear weapons and things like that. In the case of climate change, there's so many things to be concerned about. It is an invisible, odorless, tasteless gas, whether it's methane or carbon dioxide, that's warming the world and creating global weirding, more even than the warming. And while pandemics don't have an organized oppositional lobby, there's nobody out there saying, give me more pandemics. There is an organized oppositional lobby in the case of climate change, the people who have for generations made money up from fossil fuels. We shouldn't be angry at coal miners, even the coal mine owners. They didn't know that coal would create burning carbon dioxide. When we've built our industrial revolution on the backs of these coal miners, and it bothers me sometimes when people in the climate world get mad at the coal miners. It's not their fault. Nonetheless, we can't continue to burn coal, and we can't continue to burn fossil fuels. So it's a whole different business in trying to protect the world from climate change than it is in pandemics. Pandemics is mostly a technical and governance issue. Climate change is a political and lobbying issue, fighting for the hearts and minds of the people who we have to reach. I'm really pleased with what happened in Paris as far as the climate change agreements. I'm even more pleased with what happened with the CFRs, with these refrigerants that we've now increased the Montreal Protocol to cover. That's actually even better for stopping climate change than the Paris Treaty. I'm extremely encouraged because at least one of the presidential candidates believes very strongly that climate change is a real peril, Hillary, and that we must fight against it. And of course, I'm equally appalled that a presidential candidate can deny that climate change is real, Trump, and say that it's a hoax. It's not a hoax. It's real. And the level of my optimism is directly correlated with our ability to look at the problem square on. That's why when you pointed out the 1970 incidence of smallpox in India, it looked like it was zero. It's because nobody was looking at it honestly. They were hiding it. They were pretending it didn't exist. You can't be optimistic about eradicating smallpox if you deny that it exists, which is what was happening then. And you can't be optimistic about eradicating the threat from climate change if you deny that it exists. I don't think we do. I think two-thirds of Americans know that climate change is real. It's caused, unfortunately, by us and by a lot of good things that we've done. Industrialization, for example, that's brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. But we have to be honest about it. We have to look it square in the face. We have to organize. We have to figure out how to lead low-carbon lives, rebuild our urban infrastructures. It's an exciting prospect, and if we were energetic and optimistic, we'd look at this and say, here's where the jobs are going to come to replace the hollowed-out manufacturing industrial center of the United States. Here's our chance to build mass transport. Here's our chance to get on renewable fuel. And I am optimistic. I'm optimistic because so many people understand this now. It's become a priority. It's become a way of life for so many people, and especially where you are and where you're calling from. Because that's the place that we need to face up to climate change the most. And we don't have a lot of time, but we have a lot of great skills and ingenuity. And this is where America's the best. Give us a huge problem and set us loose. We'll solve it.
Do you see the energy and excitement that you described a moment ago elsewhere in the world that could be a model for us to follow?
On climate change?
Yes.
I think we're actually a laggard rather than a leader. I think that the leadership has come from the Scandinavian countries.
Yes.
Surprisingly, only recently, as China has realized, for a different reason. I mean, if you've gone to Beijing or even Shanghai, you can't go outside without choking from the pollution from burning coal. And India as well, these two countries that, you know, would always come back at us and say, listen, you're the ones who burned all the coal, you're the ones who burned all the oil, you've had your industrial revolution, it's our turn now. And that's not an invalid point. But unfortunately, there's only so much atmosphere to absorb so much pollution. And the polluters got there first. Now China is understanding that whatever the legitimacy of its claim may or may not have been, it can't continue to willy-nilly build two new coal mines a week, which it was doing, two new coal-fired electrical plants a week. So it has begun seriously pursuing an alternative energy strategy. And Obama and the Chinese premier have struck a deal. India is coming along. India, it's been a little harder for India with a distributed kind of economy and 25 different states, each with their own different rules and regulations. But Brazil has been a leader. I think you see, you know, all the island republics, which are the first ones to be hit by rising sea levels. I think President Grimson in Iceland has been a tremendous leader. I think the leadership has come from places like that. And the United States, because we're such a split country right now, and climate denial has become almost a strategy for one of the two political parties, it's become very difficult. Jeff Skoll, my friend, did a movie called Merchants of Doubt. His participant film company did a movie called Merchants of Doubt, which follows the scientists who have been persuaded, bought by the fossil fuel industry to testify that climate change was a hoax. Now, there's very few of them now. I think we're down to single digits from people who before thought that climate change was not real. But that's the key. The key is facing the situation honestly. Last year, we touched 400 parts per million. These are numbers that are frightening to any scientist who's followed the rise of the seas, the increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and rising temperatures globally. So you ask me for something optimistic. I am optimistic, but it's not 99.1. It's more like 65-35.
Right. Well, the book is amazing and so fascinating. Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventure of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. It is published by Harper One. Dr. Larry Brilliant, a great pleasure and honor to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Joe, thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Sometimes Brilliant, The Impossible Adventures of a Spiritual Seeker and Visionary Physician Who Helped Conquer the Worst Disease in History. Dr. Larry Brilliant is the author. The publisher is Harper One. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.